Welcome back to the Fury Electric Studios, home of The Zone on the Buzz Radio Network. Listen to your favorite radio station, the Buzz iPhone app, or online at 1037thebuzz.com.
Welcome back to The Zone, Chenal Country Club. Justin Anchory joined by the Pigskin Preacher today. The Access Cup going on this afternoon, and we'll talk more about all the cool things they have going on here. Actually, encouraging people who come out today, especially if you were kind enough to, or lucky enough rather, to have somebody kick in for your team to throw in a few dollars. Every dollar donated today matched up to $5,000. They're hoping to get 10 grand together for a fund, the Rebsman Fund. Recently honored Access with a $5,000 matching grant for tuition assistance. So certainly a great cause and a couple of ways to help out. So if you are riding the coattails of others today, especially, I want you to come out and do that. And the thing is, if you're not playing today, you can still come out and donate money, right? We'll take your money. It's all good. So much more on that coming up. Let's go to the Revolution Hotline, talk to Ethan Noroff of BleacherReport.com. Welcome back. Ethan, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
Great, man. Good to have you back. Well, last night, Miami Heat did what they had to do, win game two after losing game one, and LeBron James, after a slow start, pretty solid performance, 17 points, 8 rebounds, 7 assists, not the triple-double that ended in a loss in game one, but pretty solid by the end of the game when you look at the stats for him.
No question, and it just shows that LeBron James doesn't need to necessarily dominate the box score, especially from a scoring perspective, in order to control a game. He just does so many things that really don't show up in the box score, but because he's so talented and does so many things that do, I think a lot of people overlook that part of his game.
Yeah, if you were going to look at a spectrum of NBA players, at one end would be LeBron James, and at the other end would be Carmelo Anthony, who plays no defense and has never passed the ball.
No question about that. I mean, when I define the term superstar, that's not something I want to use lightly. So I would put Carmelo Anthony firmly in the star bucket, but LeBron James, that's a superstar in the NBA.
Okay, who are the let's go this. This is totally off the cuff and totally short notice, so you don't have to give me a full five, but a couple of guys that come to mind. Pigskin, feel free to chime in as well. When you think of the top five most unselfish superstars in NBA history, who are guys that, Ethan, pop in your head?
Wow, I mean, one guy for me that I always loved to root on was John Stockton. Yeah. You talk about a guy who's unselfish. That pretty much fits the mold there, always putting his team first and, you know, really just looking to dominate and control the offense. When he played for Utah for so many seasons, and he was never concerned with his own productivity. It was all about what's best for his teammates and what it took for the Jazz to win. And in doing so, he racked up some very impressive career numbers.
That's Magic Johnson.
I was just going to say,
obviously.
You know what I think we're going to do? We're going to name four point guards and LeBron James.
Yeah. Bob Cousy, if you want to go back in the 60s and 50s and 60s.
I was just thinking, what about Jason Kidd? Jason Kidd's been a star since he walked in. He's had a good, solid NBA career all the way through. He's a Hall of Famer. I mean, he's...
Kidd, for a guy that could not shoot until the last 3 years of his career, was unbelievable.
Yeah.
He couldn't shoot, and he still ran things really well. That's
unbelievable.
Hard to do.
No question about it. And you hit on something interesting, because Kidd really didn't become a shooter until the latter part of his career. And he's going to become, you know, go down in the record books when it's all said and done as one of the top three-point makers in NBA history. I mean, that's amazing.
It is. It is.
Ethan, what'd you take away from last night other than the fact that Miami played as desperate as they needed to in the final two quarters? It looked like they might have been a little gassed at the half, but they did have a five-point lead and closed it out. But what did you take away from their performance last night?
Well, honestly, through the first three quarters, or almost through the first full three quarters, I was surprised at Miami's inability to take advantage of some of the Spurs' mistakes. Spurs came out a lot sloppier than they did in Game 1, returning the ball over more frequently and just weren't really executing the way we saw in Game 1 with ruthless ability to do so. So I was a little bit surprised from Miami's standpoint on that one. But then as the game went on, and you really saw LeBron James taking a primary playmaker role when the Heat went on their stretch there, and that's what they need from him. They need him to be in the post. They need him to work from the point, and they need him to be able to really dictate that pace and space offense that Eric Spoelstra talks about so much. And that's what opens things up for the Miami Heat. That's what will open the lane for LeBron James to be more aggressive when you've got guys like Mike Miller, Shane Battier even, and Ray Allen hitting three-pointers out on the perimeter. And honestly, I like the play of Chris Bosh last night. No, he didn't have any sort of eye-popping stats, except for maybe the rebound department, because he's just been so bad there. But I really liked what I saw from Bosch, and that he wasn't playing like a two-guard. He was playing more like a traditional big man, and I think in this series against Tim Duncan and the Spurs, that's what they need from him.
A couple of stats from last night. Almost half of the Heat's points, 46 out of their 103, came in the paint. And they also outscored the Spurs 19-2 in points off turnovers. So that was about the margin of victory right there in the points off turnovers. And that was a huge key. We talked about the difference in the Spurs in game one to game two. Did you notice anything specific that was it the Miami defensive pressure? Was it lack of focus? What did you see from the Spurs that they went from 4 to 16 turnovers from game one to game two?
Well, Miami came out with a very aggressive plan to slow down Tony Parker, especially on the pick and rolls. They did a good job trapping him and taking away some of his options. Obviously, you're never going to slow down somebody like Danny Green, or so it would seem, with his ability to hit the ball from long range, or to hit the three-point ball, I should say. But when you're able to take away what Tony Parker does well, which is really that pick and roll and his ability to get into the lane, because so much of what he does is fed off of him getting into the lane and creating havoc down there. So Miami did a really good job of that. They pressured him. They took that option away. And because of it, I think he was just a little bit confused as to where to go. Because if the Heat are going to lose to Tony Parker making jump shot after jump shot, I think that's the blueprint they'll gladly take. That's a plan that, you know, if Tony Parker is going to beat the Heat in the finals on jumpers, I think the Heat would be satisfied with that, as weird as it is to say. So I think that was really a key thing, taking away that pick and roll, increasing the trap and the pressure on Tony Parker, and forcing him into quicker and maybe less efficient decisions. That's what can get Miami out on a fast break, playing their game, and really starting to dictate the play of the game, not only last night, but in the series they're moving forward.
Well, it shifts now to San Antonio. Of course, everybody understands the 2-3-2 format versus 2-2-1-1-1. Some people argue that it's a huge advantage. Some people don't think it is as much. I think for San Antonio, as Ginobili said, we heard his comments earlier, a split in Miami was fine for them. I mean, if you would have asked him before the series started, he said that would have been great for them as far as earning a split. What kind of advantage do you think a 2-3-2 is over a 2-2-1-1-1, or do you think it makes much difference?
Well, I saw a stat this morning that was pretty eye-popping in that, you know, the last 13 finals, the winner of Game 3, 12 out of 13 times, the winner of Game 3 has gone on to win the series. So that's pretty an important stat regarding this 2-3-2 format and the fact that they're now going back to San Antonio. But I don't think we'd be talking as much about it if the Spurs, or really any home team in a finals format, didn't win one of the first two games against the team that had home court advantage. I think it's a little silly to change the style of play at this point in the playoffs. If you're going to be 2-2-1-1-1 the whole way, why not have it the same for the finals? But, you know, it's been this way for a little while now. I would personally rather see 2-2-1-1-1 because I think that really benefits the team with home court advantage. And, you know, let's be honest, the teams play for home court advantage to get it at this stage if they're still playing. So I think they should be rewarded.
Yeah, I guess the only argument is playing in the East versus playing in the West. And, you know, if you're playing against a conference rival, it's a little more of a fair, you know, challenge. Although, you know, when you look at, I guess, divisional play, maybe if you're in a situation where maybe the teams are not quite as good, it's a little bit different, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how exactly, unless you play a neutral side, how you really level
it. It's really hard to beat some team of this caliber three straight, whether you're at home or somebody else's home.
Yeah.
So I think it puts a little bit of strain on the ones that are in the middle of that. So we'll see.
I'm still trying to figure out how a couple of years ago the Dallas Mavericks, which may be the most forgettable team in, as an NBA champion in the history of the NBA, beat this Miami team. But I don't know. I mean, certainly LeBron James has improved over the last season or two, but I don't know. It's they keep showing that Dirk Nowitzki fallaway shot and how it's become sort of an iconic image, and it's a commercial they make out of it for the NBA. But
I think the Teutonic gods intervened so Dirk could get his championship from Valhalla. It was a Wagnerian opera is what it was.
Yeah, this is a different LeBron James than we saw in, when Dirk Nowitzki won his title. I mean, that LeBron James was being slammed for being too passive, trying to get his teammates involved too much. And remember, during that season, we were still talking about the Miami Heat as Dwayne Wade's team and not LeBron James's. So this is a totally different player, I'd say, on both ends of the floor. Mm-hmm. And even though LeBron hasn't necessarily been the most aggressive we've seen him during the playoffs and these finals, the impact he's had on this series, especially last night, I mean, it just can't be understated. The guy does everything.
All right, so who do you like in Game 3 after what you've seen in the first two?
going into game three, believe it or not, I like the Heat, even though it's in San Antonio. I mean, the Miami Heat just showed me something that I hadn't seen from them in a while last night, a killer instinct, an ability to put their stamp on the game, whatever you want to call it. Miami really controlled the tempo when they went on that ridiculous run. They did anything and everything they wanted, and I think Miami has a blueprint of sorts to kind of now, you know, do what they need to do on both ends of the floor. On offense, they really found something that worked with LeBron James as the primary playmaker. And defensively, like we talked about, stopping that pick and roll and trapping Tony Parker caused Spurs a lot of problems. So I like what I've been seeing from Miami in this series. Game one wasn't exactly a blowout. In fact, Miami could have easily won that game had it not been for Tony Parker's miraculous shot. So, you know, it's really just that one shot. We could have a 2-0 series if he didn't hit that shot. So I like what I've seen from Miami. I still think San Antonio is a little bit too inconsistent right now. And their key contributors, this is a big one for me, San Antonio's key contributors, none of those guys are in the prime of their careers at this point, as well as Tony Parker's playing, you know, 31 years old. Not a spring chicken by NBA player standards. And obviously Manu Ginobili and Tim Duncan are both nearing the end of their careers. And in Miami, I know Dwayne Wade is not 100%, and Chris Bosh certainly isn't playing like the Chris Bosh we saw in Toronto earlier in his career. But LeBron James, the best basketball player in the world, one of the most dominant ever, is in the prime of his career and really putting the Heat on his back. So I like Miami, and I like Miami because they have the best player in the world. And in a series that's tied 1-1 with the momentum they've got going, I think the Heat are going to go into San Antonio and take a 2-1 lead.
Can't argue with any of that. I feel exactly the same way, although I'm rooting for San Antonio.
I think a lot of people are, because if LeBron James loses in these finals, you know, we ramp up those engines and start the LeBron back to Cleveland talk, because that's all it's going to be about.
That's probably true. Ethan, thanks for the time, my man. I appreciate it.
Love being on. Thank you, guys. Have a great one.
All right, take care. That's Ethan Noroff of BleacherReport.com. And a couple other things here, basketball related. We were just talking about Jason Kidd. Apparently, he's interested in the opening in Brooklyn, which I keep wanting to say New Jersey still.
Lupica, when I was in New York City last week, had a big article about that. And he was trying to compare it. He said even though Kidd has no coaching experience, he said neither did another former point guard named Mark Jackson, who did pretty well with Golden State this year.
No question.
And that's why he was trying to make those two comparisons.
Well, I saw some comments from Greg Popovich, too, a guy that I think everybody would agree is a pretty decent NBA coach. And he said, you know, look, he's played for a lot of different coaches, a lot of different styles. He's been around the league a long time. He's seen everything there is to see.
He's smart. He knows how to play. He knows how to, he's been a coach on the floor for 20 years.
Plus, my deal is if Eric Spoelstra can pretend that he's an NBA coach, Jason Kidd is vastly more more qualified than he is. So
Kidd's had a few personal problems. You know, I would, if I'm an owner, I have to make sure that those problems are behind him. Before,
such as?
Well, domestic violence and DUIs and things like that. But, you know,
he does play in the NBA.
Well,
it's sort of
true. Well, I mean, Texas Rangers still have a coach that had some problems as well, and that's working out.
So, yeah, no doubt.
You know, anyway.
Well, anyway, I think it would be interesting. And if you're, I wonder if Joe Johnson would be interested in that. It would be,
imagine
be fun.
He would.
Yeah, I would think he'd be pretty well received by the players, but you know.
Have you seen their arena there at Barclays? Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, what a great, great place!
It's too bad they weren't playing when you were in New York. You could have gone by.
Paul McCartney was playing, but I'd just seen him the week before in Tulsa. So,
well, it'll be interesting to see what shakes out there. But I think they could do a lot worse than Jason Kidd. We'll talk some more NBA coming up a little bit later as well. When we come back, I do want to talk about. We talked about some interesting numbers. I've got some interesting numbers for you as far as odds go.